What is Maine? Who is Maine? What are the stories of those who have lived here from the beginning, that migrated here, and that continue to inhabit this unique place? These are conversations from the Pointed Firs.
Welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. My guest today is Karen R. Tilburg, lawyer, conservationist, and recently retired president of the Forest Society of Maine. Karen is the author of Loving the North Woods, 25 Years of Historic Conservation in Maine, published in 2024 by Down East Books, a chronicle of remarkable activity and innovation in environmental protection in our North Woods, as accomplished by land trusts, government agencies, forest landowners, and the work of individuals who foresaw the protection of a vast segment of where we live as natural asset and contribution to our quality of life, indeed, to the spirit of Maine. So, Karen, welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs.
Well, it is such a pleasure to be here to speak with you, Peter, and to say a few words about this book that was just published this past fall, Loving the North Woods.
Which coincidentally was at your moment of retirement, as I remember, as the director of the Forest Society of Maine. We'll get to that later, but I'll probably ask you at the end, what's next? Because surely there must be something. Let's start at the beginning. I usually go back to your humble origins, where you came from, how you got to Maine, how you found this particular path.
Well, again, thank you, Peter. And I'll say that it was not intended to have this book published at the time of my retirement. I've been working on this book for about 8 years, and it was coincidental, but it also has been a good timed sequence of retirement, and now the chance to talk about this amazing bit of work here in Maine that took place over 25 years. To answer your question, my humble beginnings are humble indeed. From Pennsylvania and northern New Jersey, my father was a Lutheran minister, and he had a pastorate in Altoona, Pennsylvania for a while, and then worked for the Lutheran Church of America, and we lived in northern New Jersey. And I had a happy childhood, but I always wanted to be outside, Peter. I would bolt outside as soon as I could after church on Sundays or after school, and I always loved the woods. And that led me to study wildlife biology. I have a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Vermont. And that was a tremendous education. And I was able then to have the chance to work in Washington, D.C. on the reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act, and then the passage of the Alaska Lands Bill, H.R. 39, under President Jimmy Carter. Congressman Mo Udall was the leader sponsor of that bill, and it was a time when there was cooperation across the aisle and an amazing effort to pass legislation that brought conservation, national forests, national parks, wildlife refuges to Alaska, along with native claims settlements. A very important time. And I was inspired by that. Mm-hmm. After the bill passed, I got a job working, teaching backpacking in Maine's North Woods. And I was hired by the International Backpackers Association. And it sounded huge, and it sounded, you know, very important. And it was, in fact, a very small group run by a man named Lance Field, who met me in an old beat-up van in Lincoln. And for a summer then, I took trips, led trips down a section of the Appalachian Trail, and taught people that really didn't know backpacking. I tried to teach them the art of backpacking. And it was an experience that burned itself into my soul. I fell in love with the North Woods of Maine, and it has defined my life ever since.
If I jump back just for a minute to your family, When you look back upon how you were raised, how has that affected positively or negatively? How do you feel that your origins and your family values were inculcated in such a way that it made you who you became?
That is a wonderful question. My parents taught me to be very open to people, to listen to people, learn from people, to be aware of different people's backgrounds, to see good in people whenever possible. And I think that has really helped me through now 4-5 decades of work in being able to communicate with people who work in the North Woods, around the North Woods, who own land in the North Woods, who many struggle to make ends meet in gateway communities around the North Woods. And, so I think that ability to meet people where they are and respect them and listen to them and learn from them and work with them as they have their dreams, to find a way to achieve, in this case, conservation in the North Woods and maintain community and economic health. I attribute that to my parents, that ability to be open.
Do you retain a religious connection?
I do a bit, yes. I continue to go to Lutheran church now and then. I won't say I'm steady. I'm more of a Church of the Blue Sky person, and that's where I feel close to the Great Spirit, as I call the Great Spirit. And the North Woods are a big part of my Great Spirit.
The Church of the Blue Sky. Mm-hmm. It's a great phrase. Calls out for a poem.
Well, all right. One thing in my book that is perhaps a bit unusual is in between each chapter, I have a poem that I've written, and they are matched somewhat to the chapter before or after it. And I'm going to read a poem that talks about how I feel about the woods, and it's called My House. My house is the forest. Often I walk in its rooms, each bend in the path a door to green magic. In this house, my breath escapes to the sky. Light enters countless windows, and the forest accepts my stride. Here, I slow to the pace of weather and trees. In one room, birches and maples. In another, spruce, fir, and moss. Water, bark, leaf, and branch form infinite arrangements. Certain combinations of the forest startle me with recognition of a green room I have visited before. In this house of mine.
Wonderful. It actually suggests something we're going to talk about later, the Green Cathedral.
Yes.
Let's define the North Woods. You call it a great vast forest, and it is surprisingly large. Can you talk a little bit about how we define the North Woods?
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's huge. The area most people consider the North Woods is about 12 million acres. Many people are familiar generally with the size of Connecticut, and 3.5 times Connecticut fit in this area of the North Woods.
Astonishing.
And it is an area that most of it has no public roads. The roads that are there are owned by the landowners for commercial forest management. They haul trees and forest products over the woods, the roads. But it's an area that has very few people that live in it. It's an area that includes the unorganized territories of Maine, and these are areas that have no town, no municipal government. And it's a vast area. And one of my goals in writing this book is to help readers sense how vast it is. And become more aware of it and hopefully learn to love it themselves if they don't already. It's, you know, people talk about the Amazon and they talk about huge forests in other parts of the world, but we really have our own Amazon here. This is one of the last intact temperate forests, certainly in the Americas, but probably the globe. And a quote from some researchers indicates that it's the largest, most intact, contiguous temperate forest in North America, perhaps globally, that has remained continuously forested since pre-settlement times. And that is a remarkable fact. And it is a place that continues to exist as it did when indigenous people, Wabanaki, were here for 12,000 years or more. And it is something that unless we pay attention to it and do what we can, we could lose this vast, unfragmented, undeveloped place.
I think it's important to repeat the fact that it may seem vast and empty and unpopulated, but it has been inhabited, as you say, for thousands of years.
Thousands of years, yes.
So the unimaginable happens. Suddenly you're a backpacker, you become a de facto ecologist, you've fled Washington, D.C., and now you come into this vastness. What happens? What was the thing that occurred that not only enabled your career, but enabled the success that we're talking about?
Well, let's focus on the ownership of this place. This place, vast, again, huge, 12 million acres, more than half of Maine, was owned really by a very few number of landowners. And these landowners were mostly paper companies. Companies with names like International Paper, Great Northern, Georgia Pacific, Scott Paper, their family ownership, Seven Islands, Pingree, Champion, Frazier, probably 12 landowners, maybe 15, owned most of the North Woods. And it had been managed for forest products for 100 or more years. Had been, in some cases, land had been acquired and accumulated by some of these paper companies. And many of these landowners, these paper companies, had not only owned the land, but they had paper mills. And they also, some of them, owned hydro facilities. So there was a term called a vertically integrated companies. And many of these paper companies were vertically integrated, meaning that they could harvest the wood on the land that they owned. They could make it into paper or other forest products in the mills that they owned. And some of them could even run the mills with the electricity that was generated by the hydro facilities that they owned. And this was the way things were. Certainly when I was teaching backpacking and when I started learning to love the North Woods. And it had been that way for communities, workers, the economy. The definition of the characteristic of Maine was as a paper company economy. And it was very, very integrated into our psyche. Suddenly, Peter, this is just what was so surprising and so cataclysmic, really, for people, is that in just a decade, starting in the late 1980s, around 1990 to about 1999, 9.1 million acres of forest lands exchanged hands, and that's about half of Maine. And it took place through about 34 transactions. And after the dust settled, after this decade, there really weren't any paper company ownerships of forest land anymore. A couple of the family ownerships continued, but the paper company sold their land. And this sent shockwaves through Maine, through every part of Maine that had any relationship to the forest, forest products, forest economy, and also people that love to recreate in the North Woods. And the questions were, why are these paper companies selling the land? And what's going to happen? And who are these new buyers that came in? And so I'll first start by saying that why the paper companies sold the land. And there are a number of reasons. I think different people might put different weight on some of these factors. But paper in the around that time was becoming a more globally competitive market, paper products. And so other countries had paper mills that were more efficient, that could make paper more inexpensively. And so there was increasing competition for paper. There was also a number of pressures from Wall Street to divest the companies from non-performing assets. And so the paper companies owned this land, and yes, they were harvesting the wood from it to benefit their mills, but it wasn't making a lot of money for them actively. It was sort of a quiet asset, and it was non-performing. And then additionally, at around that same time, there were changes to the tax codes that affected how the capital gains from the sale of timber would be treated and made it less economical for paper companies that were usually created to be a corporation. They would actually become double taxed for the capital gains and other revenues.
This is Conversation from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors, artists, makers, and exemplars who invoke the spirit of Maine, broadcast on the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, streamed and archived at weru.org and available as podcast at pointedfirs.org. I'm speaking today with Karen R. Tilburg on her new book, Loving the North Woods, 25 Years of Historic Conservation in Maine, published by Down East Books and available at your local bookstore.
And so all of those factors combined to result in paper companies selling their land. And it didn't just happen in Maine. It was across the northern forest and other areas where paper mills owned forest land. And it was such a shock to people. And it happened so quickly. And so the legislature in Maine was paying attention, and Congress, the U.S. Congress started paying attention. And there became a really strong interest in the U.S. senators across the Northern Forest in trying to get a handle on what this meant and what was going to be the future of the Northern Forest, which includes the forests from New York to Vermont to New Hampshire to Maine. And so during this time, around 1990 or so, the U.S. Congress established a Northern Forest Land Study under the Department of Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, that looked at what was causing these sales and what could happen here and what were the risks to the economy that people and that these states depended on, and the culture and the traditions and the spirit. And you had talked about the spirit of Maine, you know, the North Woods in Maine and the North Woods in these other states. It was essential to how people thought of themselves and their home and their state. Out of the Northern Forest Study, which identified quite a bit of information, collected information, it didn't really come up with recommendations that people felt comfortable with. And so then a Northern Forest Lands Council was created. And that was a representative group of leaders from each of those four states, selected by the governor of each of those four states, to really listen and hear from the people and gather even more information and to come up with recommendations for the future. And that took place over a period of about 4 years.
Let me just interrupt you for one moment here. I want to go back to the why a little bit. The timing, I can maybe begin to understand, but the fact that they all did it at the same time indicates a force that seems illogical to me, in the sense that the demand for paper hadn't diminished. And so that suddenly there was a kind of reclassification within these conglomerates of non-performing assets. And that's something you'd think we might learn from. We did learn from it in a way, and we'll keep talking about how we did. But the fact is that the ecosystem service value of the forest was never considered in those considerations. That they would come to such a short-term collective decision all at once. It speaks a lot to how we value things.
Well, those are very wise reflections, Peter. And I think that rapid and almost unified sell-off reveals sort of a groupthink from Wall Street. And it was, well, they're doing it, we should too. And, why should our company have these non-performing assets when obviously the other companies just made quite a bit of money selling their forest land, and, maybe we should too. And I think what struck me at the time, and many people, there was a sense that these companies were neighbors. I mean, there were people that worked in the companies that lived in the communities that were foresters and managers. And suddenly, I think they were surprised too. It was a very fearful and confused time and puzzling, because people here knew that there were a lot of those values that you were speaking to, Peter. Mm-hmm. The watershed values, the wildlife values, the recreational values, and the forest ecosystem values that provides so much benefit to the public. And that was not valued, obviously, by these sell-offs.
So in order to respond, you needed, first of all, to gather together the coalition of the vulnerable, mostly individuals and small groups who did understand the value that we're talking about. But what was the tool that made it happen? The prospect at the time must have just been so intimidating. How are we going to do it? It's so big. It's so valuable. How are we going to define a response? And what's the tool we're going to use?
Well, I'm going to start first with the fact that these U.S. congressional studies and outreach mobilized people. And not everyone was in agreement on what to do. But people across those four states and people in Maine participated. They went to listening sessions, they're called, or gatherings to talk about what they were worried about. And they started to see their neighbors at those gatherings, and they started to talk to each other, looking at organizing principles. This was an amazing process that helped people feel like they could do something. So I think a sense of it, that you could participate and your voice might make a difference and your ideas could influence the outcome, was really important to what happened next. And so I will talk in a minute or two about a number of local groups that formed coming out of these studies. But a tool that was recommended for possible consideration to be used is a tool of easement, a conservation easement. And so I'll just speak briefly about what a conservation easement is, because not everyone knows. Peter, let's assume that you own 100,000 acres of forest land, and you'd like to continue to own that land and manage it, let's say, sustainably for forest products, and you want to, hold on to it, but you really don't want to see it developed. You don't want to see the lakes on that land subdivided with second homes. You don't want to see roads infiltrating or utility corridors or mining on that land. You want to see it stay a forest. You could work with the state or groups. There are a number of NGOs in Maine where you could talk to them about selling or giving a conservation easement. And a conservation easement is a legal document, usually they're permanent, whereby you transfer all those rights that you would have as a private property owner to develop those lakefront homes, to put in new utility corridors or to mine for minerals or even water. And you give those rights, you transfer them in this legal document to the state or to a qualified NGO to hold forever. And that is a permanent, perpetual document that is monitored. Those rights are held by those entities, so to speak, and they monitor your actions on that land to be sure that you are complying with the easement, and they do so forever. And so that tool of easement was recommended to be considered because much of the Northwoods are privately owned, and many of the landowners did want to continue to own and manage for forest products, but some were open to the idea of really keeping it as a forest and not letting it get fragmented and developed and divided. So the tool of the conservation easement became a really important part of a strategy moving forward. And I can tell you the missing link here in this sequence, and that is, you know, who bought all the land that was sold by the forest paper companies? And again, you know, half of the state basically was sold by the paper companies that owned the Northwoods at the time. And a number of different new kind of landowners came in. There's a term called real estate investment trust, and another term, timber investment management organization. And Maine saw a number of timber investment management organizations, or TIMOs, buy a lot of these forest lands. And a TIMO basically is a pooled funds from investors that are managed by a management company, a TIMO management company, and they bought hundreds of thousands of acres, millions of acres in Maine, to manage for forestry for their investors. But the amazing thing is that many of those management entities, on behalf of their investors, were interested in selling easements. The paper companies hadn't been interested in conservation. They were focused on the management of their forests for their mills. They were very leery of conservation, feeling that if a conservation group or a state had acquired some forest land for conservation in their midst, in the middle of their ownership, that would be a nose under the tent and that they would lose their ability to manage as they wished for forest products. But the TIMO's management companies saw that this was a way to externalize some of those values of wildlife, watershed, recreation that were in the forest that the paper companies hadn't, as you pointed out, recognized or valued, and that in the form of an easement, those values could be identified and actually appraised. And then through an easement, they would be safeguarded forever. Many, many pros and cons to what happened during this time, but one of the positive outcomes was the willingness of some of the new landowners to entertain conservation on their lands. Also, some conservation entities and the state were able to buy land. And that was really important, right? Because some of the areas were so important along the St. John River, for example, and the Debskenigs, the Emerald Cathedral, and others. To give a sense of this, it was like the window opened for conservation that this window had been shut for 100 years or more.
It's such an irony that somehow the same value that the timber companies calculated as against shareholder value is now by the new operators calculated as investor return. There's a terribly misunderstood irony there. Let's talk about an early example of that, of success. What would be the one that you'd want to pick to demonstrate how the easement could be applied at vast return?
Well, I'll start with one that is kind of a special story in my heart, and that is in the Down East Lakes area. This is in the eastern Maine, a vast area, and it's sort of the eastern part of the North Woods. And that in, many people are familiar with Grand Lake Stream. It's the hundreds of thousands of acres around Grand Lake Stream. This is a story where Georgia Pacific had owned hundreds of thousands of acres. And then, as we have been talking about, Peter sold it. And the community of Grand Lake Stream is made up of small business owners, many guides, Maine licensed guides, who have over generations brought sports to the area to take them fishing for landlocked salmon and bass in the big lakes. And this is an area that is also very important to the Wabanaki. And there was this shock wave, like, what is happening here, when Georgia Pacific sold? I was working for a coalition called the Northern Forest Alliance, and I spent a lot of time in Grand Lake Stream talking to folks about this, and their fear was palpable, and their sense of loss of control over their future and a place that was essential to them was palpable. So the fear caused some deep anxiety, and they were really unsure what to do. And because of the training I have, I also am an attorney and had done a lot of outreach around this already through the Northern Forest Lands process, I encouraged them to try to identify a vision they had that they would like for these hundreds of thousands of acres. You know, what would they like to see? What would be their ideal moving forward? And this rather small group of individuals sat down and started to try to identify and articulate a vision for the land. And over a short period of time, they did. And basically, they wanted to see the forest stay as forest. They supported forest management so long as it was sustainable and very thoughtful. They wanted the highest levels of protection for what they called the Farm Cove Peninsula, which extended deeply into West Grand Lake, where a lot of the sports took their clients for fishing and shore lunches. And they wanted to be part of the future of the woodlands there. So They came up with a map, and they came up with those goals. And I said, let's meet with the land manager that on behalf of this TIMO that bought the group. The TIMO was called Typhoon LLC. And so I happened to have enough of a relationship with the manager, Wagner Forest Management. And I called and said, would you be willing to meet with a group of people from Grand Lake Stream? It was Tom Colgan was the man I called, and he said, yes, I'll come on up. So a group of us went up to meet with him, and we were so nervous, Peter. I remember, I think we stopped for cheesecake on the way up just to calm our stomachs. I mean, it was, you know, when we had the map and the vision and everything, and so we got there, and he and one of his colleagues were there, and we were sitting in his office, and the leader of the group presented the map and presented the goals. And, you know, the goal was to acquire an easement over 300,000 acres, Peter, and to buy, I think it was 40,000 acres for the Farm Cove. And Tom, I remember him leaning back and not saying anything for a few minutes. And then he leaned forward and looked at us and he said, well, if you can find a partner, a land transaction conservation partner who has experience in this, we'll consider it. And we about fell on the floor. I mean, this was so incredible to have the green light to try, at least. Mm-hmm. And so we drove back home, kind of, you know, just ecstatic but nervous, and then began a series of local living room meetings. The group reached out to the New England Forestry Foundation, and a wonderful man named Keith Roth came up to try to talk about how to do this with the group. And I joined many of those meetings. And I termed the chapter What Courage Looks Like. That's the name of the chapter of this story. And I just remember particularly one critical meeting in Ed McGrath's living room there in Grand Lake Stream. And we're sitting there, and Keith Ross is there, and I was there, and the group leaders were there. And someone said, "Well, Keith, how much is this going to cost?" And Keith kind of thought for a minute, and he said, "Well, probably $30 million or maybe more." And people were just quiet. There was not a whisper. There was not, you could just, I mean, I just wasn't sure what was going to happen.
If you are just joining us, this is Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. And my guest today is Karen R. Tilburg, lawyer, conservationist, and recently retired president of the Forest Society of Maine. Karen is the author of Loving the North Woods, 25 Years of Historic Conservation in Maine, published in 2024 by Down East Books, here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, streamed and archived at weru.org, and available as podcast at pointedfirs.org.
And then after a minute, people started looking at each other and began to nod in affirmation. And they said, "Yeah, let's do it." And I was deeply moved by that moment. I will never forget it. And, you know, these were people that made very modest incomes. And they were willing to take on an enormous task, took years to accomplish, and they did accomplish it. They raised the money, worked closely with NEF, and many others supported them. That it's now reality. Hundreds of thousands of acres are forever protected from development there. They own Farm Cove Peninsula and actually have acquired some additional lands. And that area of the North Woods, which is unlike other parts, it's a lot of water there. And people that have flown over it say there's more water than land. It's a deeply moving place, haunting in its wateriness.
Let me just interrupt and put on my water hat for a moment, only to say that the entire North Woods is the inherent reservoir that feeds the ocean. All of it filters down one way or another, underground, on the ground, and nurtures the entire biodiversity of the state, including human habitation. I love Grand Lakes. I've been through a couple of times, and it really is a charming sort of otherworldly place that was sort of built around rusticating and sport. That your group was severely infected by that sort of psychological connection with the outdoors, which gave them courage. I mean, raising that kind of money in Maine at that time was not a frequent thing. And so to be able to go out there and to gather together, pull it together, persevere and succeed really is a remarkable tribute, not just to them, but basically to all the people, including the government, and also charitable contributions and functions outside of the state that supported it.
And Peter, it's a story that I hope will continue to inspire as we move forward, that a relatively small group of people who care deeply can make huge change. And that is something I hope we all can remember moving forward.
Yeah. Can you give me another example of a sort of a different approach that worked?
So many people, I think, were aware of a very large lake development proposal that the Plum Creek Company had submitted to the Land Use Regulation Commission, so-called at the time, to develop a number of resorts and a large number of potential second homes or dwellings. And let's just, again, remember that all of these stories relate to the sale of the paper companies and or the changes in the tax law. So Moosehead Lake, you know, huge, beautiful, undeveloped lake in northern Maine, surrounded by forest lands, had been owned by Scott Paper and then had been sold to Sappy, and then Sappy sold to Plum Creek. And that was around the time of these big sales. Plum Creek was a real estate investment trust, one of these new kinds of landowners. And it's a category of ownership that relates to real estate as a function of its corporate being. And people were quite concerned about the fact that a real estate investment trust had acquired 900,000 acres in Maine. And so, in fact, when Plum Creek submitted a lake concept plan for a large area around Moosehead Lake, there was great concern about what this would mean for the communities nearby, for the forests, for the recreation, for the wildlife and fisheries. And what then embarked was a very bitter process led by Lurk about the Lake Concept Plan that took a number of years. And the book doesn't dwell on that. What the book talks about is the fact that out of a Lake Concept Plan that was ultimately approved by Lurk, there was a requirement for about a 360,000 acre easement was required to be formalized by Plum Creek to counterbalance the degree of development that the Lake Concept Plan would enable. And it was under the Lake Concept rules, you had to balance the development with permanent conservation. Mm-hmm. And so the Lake Concept Plan required a 360,000 acre easement. And Forest Society of Maine was named as the holder of the easement, with a state being a backup holder. So that was basically approved. It was then appealed to the courts.
Who appealed?
There were interveners that appealed, and I know the Natural Resources Council of Maine was one, and I believe the Maine Audubon Society might have been one, and there may have been others. But they had been interveners in the LURC process, and they were appealing the Lake Concept Plan that was approved. So the easement was sort of there, but was a little unclear whether the whole thing was going to be approved or not approved. And so it was sort of a weird time there. Finally, the law court upheld the Land Use Regulation Commission's Lake Concept Plan approval, and the easement became permanent. And so now there exists a 360,000 acre easement around Moosehead Lake held by the Forest Society of Maine. But it doesn't stop there, Peter. What the Lake Concept Plan did then enable the possibility for, I think it's two resorts and quite a bit, like over 1,000, maybe 2,000 development units. And everyone wondered, when was that going to happen? And, you know, there were people that kind of wanted that, thinking it would be economically beneficial, and there were people that were still very opposed to that. But nothing happened really there. There were a few requirements that came out of the Land Use Regulation Commission approval, such as creating new hiking trails, which were, I was part of a group that the state held to create these new hiking trail easements, and that was done, and there was some land transferred for to the state for camping. That was a requirement, and that happened. But nothing happened with the development. And then Plum Creek sold its land to Weyerhaeuser, across the United States. And essentially, Weyerhaeuser, which is a massive forest land ownership, gobbled up Plum Creek, and there is no more Plum Creek now. They kind of consumed, if you will, all of Plum Creek. And so Weyerhaeuser then became owner of all the Plum Creek lands in Maine. And they are a forest management company, and they continue to manage for forestry in Maine and elsewhere around the country. And the Forest Society, you know, was monitoring the easement, and life was going on. And then I was working at the Forest Society at the time, a representative from Weyerhaeuser, a very warm and committed individual named Luke Muzzy, called me and said, "Karen, I need to stop by." And he came by my office and said, "Karen, Weyerhaeuser has decided to terminate, or to ask to terminate, the Lake Concept Plan." And I was shocked. This was something that the former owner had spent upwards of $25 million to try to have approved. But Weyerhaeuser wasn't interested in developing the land, and they let most people think that they just wanted to manage the areas that had been set aside as potential development for forest management. And ultimately, they were able to have LURC terminate the Lake Concept Plan. But the amazing thing is that, of course, the easement's permanent. So the easement continues on and will continue forever into the future. And so some people have used the term, you know, this snatched victory from the jaws of defeat. It's a crazy story, Peter. I will always remember sitting there at my conference room table with Luke, and as he told me that they were going to petition to terminate the Lake Concept Plan. And so there is no more Lake Concept Plan.
You wonder the backstory of Plum Creek. Who were they? Many of them, I suspect, might even have been our neighbors that were invested in this thing. I'm not sure, have no idea. How could they have profited at all? They must have lost an enormous amount of money based on an ill-conceived concept from the very beginning. And so there is justice in the disappearance, in the sense that the concept was improved and actually proved to be probably not very profitable at all for the first round of investors. And then the second round, Weyerhaeuser realizes that they don't want to be in that business anyway, and it's the wrong thing to do. And so they go back, and here we are again, back to a paper company essentially managing the forest for their commercial purposes, and at the same time having created this amazing barrier around Moosehead Lake, which really is a treasure. So I read this and sort of gave a little shout for our team. It sounded like it really was a victory, even if it was inadvertent.
Well, it had twists and turns that you couldn't have imagined. And right. If I could just point out a couple other lessons or features of this. You know, I've been working in the Greenville area for decades, first with when I was staff attorney at Maine Audubon, and then with the Northern Forest Alliance, and then with the state, and then Forest Society of Maine. And I've grown to really care about the people there. And I've been on the Economic Development Corporation there to be aware of how hard people work to make ends meet there. And the economy is, it's not a four-season economy. It's a rough economy where, you know, some months there's no economy. And they all worry about their children leaving, and they worry about whether there's enough, you know, young people coming into the school to keep the institutions alive and all. I think what was hard for me observing this time was the conflict between people that wanted the development and that didn't. They're good guys on each side. But it did tear up the community at the time. The forces that were pro the development forces again. There was vandalism. FBI came in and took cheek swabs of people. And it was really icky, you know, it was icky. And I'm happy that since then, the community's really come together. they created this Economic Development Corporation. There's a very strong local Moosehead Chamber of Commerce, essentially. There are a lot of good civic groups there, and people are working together to try to forge a strong, resilient economy with conservation being a core part of it. And that is what has been so beautiful, to know that they value the conservation part of it as a stable part of their livelihood. And that if you're a guide, or if you're in the wood products business, or if you're a hotelier, you know the forest is going to be there. It's going to be beautiful. It won't be developed, and people can access it. It can't be gated. It's a real positive for the future.
Well, after 25 years, you can measure the success of all of that goodwill and good work. It's an astonishing increase in the sense of taking a raw material, an area that's sort of unidentified or is identified otherwise, and then running it through a series of processes where the public benefit has been absolutely amazing to me. When you look at the statistics of how much 25 years ago land was in the North Woods was preserved, to what's now there, and to the proof of concept that is now coming in the renaissance of in tourism and outdoor recreation and all this sort of thing for job protection and continuity. What's next?
Well, I'll emphasize that during this period of time, Maine went from 5% of the state being in some form of conservation to 20%. 20%.
Yeah.
But we're at 22% now in 2025, but during this period of time, we went from 5% to 20%. That's 4 million acres were put into some form of conservation during this period of time. And there are other stories too, the Katahdin and Debskenegs and the Pingree and Neff easement and the West Branch in Subumic and the 100 Mile Wilderness AMC project and the St. John. I mean, each chapter goes over to the stories and the hardship, and each of them almost lost too. I mean, they're nail biters and edge of the seat and near failure for each of these. But people persevered. And so in terms of what's next, certainly if anything, during the last 30 years, so 25 of this book and up to the current time, we've only learned even more about how important the North Woods are. The North Woods are deemed globally significant for migratory songbirds. Everywhere else in the U.S., songbird populations are declining, but they are not declining in the North Woods. They're increasing for most species. That's enormous. It's a bird sanctuary. And we have these, as you mentioned so eloquently, these huge river systems draining from the North Woods. You know, the West Branch, the Androscoggin, the Kennebec, the St. John, the St. Croix. I mean, these huge river systems pull from these forests fresh water, clean water, cold water in many cases, and wild fish populations and iconic Maine animals continue to exist in our North Woods. And so we've brought conservation to a good percentage, but the North Woods are 12 million acres, and let's say maybe 4 have conservation. And it would, I think, be essential for us to continue to work with landowners and communities and each other to bring conservation to the entirety of it.
What about the sequestration value of all that land?
Maine's forest overall, the entire state, sequester 91% of our greenhouse gases every year. 91%. And so we've got to hold on to these forests. There's also work underway to identify forest management strategies that can sequester and store even more carbon. And the idea of paying landowners to use these forest management strategies as a way to store more carbon. And so there's huge potential there. A number of large landowners have already sold carbon offsets from their forests, and as that's another asset that they have. So the whole forest carbon arena is evolving. There's a lot of science taking place and research. The soils in the forests are so essential for carbon. And the whole network of mycorrhizae and soils and trees and photosynthesis is powerful and essential for carbon sequestration. So yes, there's much more to come for that.
And the wealth inherent in the water system as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a massive purification system up there that makes us a water-rich state in a way that hasn't yet really been fully understood, not to be harvested and exported and put in plastic mm-hmm. bottles, but for many, many, many other reasons.
And dark sky is another asset. You know, we have lost a dark sky in a lot of places in the world. We are animals. Animals have evolved to have dark sky to navigate, to know where we are in our lives, and so to speak. And we've lost a lot of dark sky, but the Northwoods still has dark sky, and it's an asset that we, you know, are using for recreation tourism. But it's also important to, I think, our success as a species.
Right. Can you leave us with another poem?
Well, yes. How about Machias on Wing? This is Machias in the Grand Lake Stream area, where a lot of that conservation took place. And it's a wonderful paddle river, but you have to do it at the right time before the water runs out. So usually in the spring. Machias on Wing. Fourth day of paddling from fifth to first Machias Lake. Each lake connected by river, like shining drops of dew on a stem of grass. Cool, moist days showed off early leatherleaf and rhodora, and the sweet green of new growth, bold and pushy against the tired husks of last year's exuberance. This old place held us quietly as we descended through ledge, bog, and forest, surrounded by warbler's song and the insistent awakening of life. Sunshine warms us on the last day, as it does turtles on river drive logs. A veil of pale wings rise from the water to encircle us. Mayflies, Epeiurus, floating slowly upwards. Machias on Wing.
Thank you, Karen.
You're welcome.
My guest today has been Karen R. Tilburg, and we have been discussing the remarkable history of the preservation of Maine's North Woods as a unique contribution to environmental protection and outdoor recreation for our future in Maine. This has been Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. Thanks for listening.